Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It may sound strange coming after 6 months of chaos in Libya, but it looks like now a really critical phase is about to begin, building a political and economic system. Coming up, what's at stake in Libya and for all of us who consume the country's precious oil. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Allianz, providing retirement solutions that can help to guarantee income for life through its affiliated companies in the U.S., AllianzUSA.com. Entrepreneurship reporting is supported by Deluxe Corp, a marketing resource to 4 million small businesses with logo and website design, search engine marketing, and more at deluxe.com/marketing.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, good day to you. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal, who's getting a much-deserved break from the financial hubbub. Thanks for joining us. It's looking more and more like we can bid farewell to the dictator known as the Mad Dog of the Middle East, more than 40 years after Muammar Gaddafi took control of the country in a military coup. This morning, President Obama declared the rule of Gaddafi over. His statement followed a push by opposition fighters into the Libyan capital of Tripoli. Loud and repeated gunfire could be heard over a telephone line as one of Gaddafi's sons was being interviewed by the Al Jazeera News Service. A short time later, he was reported captured by the rebels. But there's no word of Gaddafi's whereabouts. To get a sense of where this seems to be headed and what it means for the people there, we turn to Professor Mansour Al-Kikya. He's a political science professor at the University of Texas in San Antonio and a native of Libya. Welcome.
Thank you.
How surprised were you by the developments of this weekend and today?
I was very surprised at the speed of the push. I didn't think it would go so fast. I was always a firm believer in when, not if, and this has been borne out. But I was really a bit worried about the speed, and I think my worry is proving to be true because now the revolutionaries are finding the pushback from Gaddafi forces, and it's causing a little bit of a headache.
You were just in Libya before the summer. You have friends and family there. How are people feeling?
Elated that they ended the Gaddafi regime. I mean, it's really funny how people change, just given a little bit of freedom and to express themselves. And I've seen this for the first time in Libya in many, many, many years.
If Gaddafi is ousted once and for all, what happens the next day?
I tell you, it will be a joyous day once Gaddafi is ousted, and then they have a new problem emerging: how to recreate Libya in a different vision, and that's going to be a much, much more difficult job to do than removing Gaddafi.
Yeah, how confident are you that the rebels can stabilize the country then and build something sustainable?
I think they will. I think the intentions are quite good, and they're not seeking power, and they're trying their best to obtain legitimacy. And after Gaddafi is removed, they will have elections to bring to power a constitutional, a legitimate government to undertake the elections and writing of the new constitution. I think they will do it.
But it's going to be tough, isn't it? I mean, there's no economy to speak of other than oil.
Of course. But Libya never had an economy other than oil. For the last 40 years, Libya's 99.9% dependent on oil. And hence, this is Libya's dilemma for many years. Gaddafi's rule has done little to ameliorate the situation.
Now, most of the food is imported there. 70% of the population is employed by the public sector. If something happens, it has to happen fast, no?
It has to happen very fast, and the council must demonstrate that they have something better than Gaddafi to the Libyan people, and they must do it very, very fast.
Now, as far as building a real political and economic system in Libya, what would you like to see first?
Well, the truth is, the first thing I would really like to see, I'd like to see a constitutional framework that allows for checks and balances, that first of all provides some means to protect rights. And the rest will have to come over time based on Libyan experience. 40 years is a long time. To achieve a miracle over 1 year or 6 months is not possible. It's going to take 2, 3, 4 years, maybe 5 years to have a new system in place to iron out some of the bugs. And it's going to grow, keep on growing. That's it. That's what we can hope for.
When are you going to go back?
First week of next month.
And what are you hoping to find?
The chaos, but we'll survive it. It's a wonderful chaos.
Mansoor Al-Kikia is a political science professor at the University of Texas in San Antonio. Thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
The impending end of the six-month-long conflict in Libya is likely to reduce the price of oil around the world. By most estimates, Libya can resume pumping close to 2% of the world's daily supply of oil within a year or two. But right away, Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports, the end of the Gaddafi regime is expected to give a psychological boost to world oil markets.
What oil markets missed most during months of fighting in Libya wasn't so much quantity as quality.
They produce some of the highest quality crude in the world.
John Kingston with the energy service company Platts says Libyan oil is light and sweet, easy to refine. And he says the rebels who have ousted Muammar Gaddafi are promising to get the oil pumps working again as soon as possible.
They made very clear all along that if they were to take power, they would respect the contracts that the Gaddafi government had signed with various Western oil companies to explore. And these companies know that they can go right back in and get to work.
Another reason for a dramatic short-term psychological boost to oil markets is the speed of the rebel takeover, says Jeff Porter of North Africa Risk Consulting.
A lot of oil analysts hadn't expected any positive news to come out of Libya more broadly until after Labor Day, and that would postpone any return of production into the middle of 2012, but now there's the possibility that Libya may be able to start domestic production on its own before the end of the year.
Still, Porter expects Libya's psychological effects on oil prices will be short-lived. The global economy's performance will have a more lasting influence. Faster growth means higher demand, and since supplies are tight, even with Libya's contribution, that means higher prices. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Wall Street rallied by better than 2% out of the gate, but just couldn't keep up that pace. Details when we do the numbers. Aside from Libya, of course, we still have our own problems at home, mainly the economy. We had a recovery that felt like it wasn't. Now, several Wall Street economists say we're staring another potential recession in the face. What to do? Experts are divided. Should we try more federal spending to stimulate the economy, or just stop the government meddling and let it grow on its own? Later this week, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke will signal what, if anything, the central bank will try to do to make everything happy. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore reports.
Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke has picked up several nicknames. Big Ben, the bearded one. Quincy Crosby is a strategist for Prudential Financial, and she likes another nickname.
Ben Bernanke has become the market whisperer, if you will. When he speaks, the market listens.
The markets will be listening when Bernanke speaks at a gathering of economists later this week. And what do they want to hear?
If you're in the market, you want to hear Bernanke throw more money from the sky. You want him to do something to save you.
That's Peter Buchvar, an equity strategist with Miller Tabak. He thinks the Fed is trying too hard to please the markets. Last year, Bernanke signaled a plan to buy $600 billion of Treasury bonds to force down interest rates. This year, the Fed's ability to deliver another market-moving stimulus is dubious.
In essence, what the market wants to hear is, does the Federal Reserve have any more viable tools in the toolkit that can actually help the economy?
The Fed has already promised the market's favorite stimulus, interest rates near zero, for two more years. How does the Fed top that? It doesn't.
Perhaps he comes out and says, ladies and gentlemen, that was my present to the market. I'm leaving rates low for a very long time.
Some worry that we're expecting too much from the Fed. For really big changes to the economy, Congress will also need to pull its levers. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
And that leads us to this, one of those could-be-worse but still not exactly good stories that we've become so used to. Salaries are expected to go up 2.8% on average next year, according to a survey from the HR consulting firm Towers Watson. That's a whopping 0.2% tick up from the average pay raises seen over the past 2 years. But it could be a sign employers are a little more optimistic about the economy. For workers, though, no big woo-hoo, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Sure, raises are up, but not enough to keep up with prices, says economist Chris Christopher at IHS Global Insight.
inflation has crept up quite a bit, and gasoline is actually retreating. But food prices and non-energy and non-food are actually higher than general wage increases for most people.
Lori Beanstock is with Towers Watson, the firm that did the wage survey. She says raises aren't really intended to help people keep up with the cost of living anyway. With budgets tight, companies want to reward their highest-performing employees with substantial merit raises that put them ahead of the economic curve and leave others behind.
Highest possible rating, we may see an average increase of 4.5% versus below average, 1.5%. So less to play with, but perhaps more of an eye on differentiating to really give to those higher performers.
Some employers are doing well enough to give everybody a boost. The employees at John Madigan's Veterinary Clinic in Kaiser, Oregon, have been getting raises above 5% throughout the recession.
The reason that we've been able to do that is just we've been continually busier. We've extended our hours. We've gone to, you know, late nights on Tuesdays and Thursdays. We're now open on Sundays.
Madigan says with higher productivity per worker, the practice is bringing in more revenue, while many of his costs, like insurance and rent, have barely budged. So now he's got more profits to pass around. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We continue today with our breakdown coverage, Our Economy One Step at a Time. Last week, we looked at some of the pressing narratives in this current climate: job creation, government debt, our place in the global economy. So now we turn to this question: how do we get the American economy working again? Commentator David Leonhardt has this idea: a time machine.
This time machine would start its magic by taking us back almost a decade to the days when everyone from senior Washington officials to ordinary Americans believed that house prices could never drop. We'd then have a chance to persuade Alan Greenspan and Ben Bernanke, the last two Federal Reserve chairmen, to stop saying that nationwide housing bubbles could not happen and to start cracking down on the wishful thinking mortgages that were making that bubble possible. We would also stop by the Treasury Department and Congress and ask them to give some more attention to the fact that incomes were stagnating, and many Americans were using their credit cards to pay for higher living standards. Finally, we'd pay a visit to Wall Street. We'd go to Lehman Brothers and explain to the bigwigs there why they might not want to be borrowing $33 for every $1 in assets they held. If they didn't listen to us, we'd go see a gentleman named Timothy Geithner, then overseeing the regulators at the New York Fed. In every case, we would issue an urgent message. The United States economy is in the midst of creating the worst economic excesses since the 1920s. If allowed to continue, those excesses will do enormous damage, damage that you won't be able to stop once it starts. This damage, of course, is what we are living through right now. And as much as we may all wish that there were an easy fix, there isn't. Financial crises cause spending to be depressed and unemployment to be high for years. Are there steps we can take to mitigate the damage? Absolutely. An aggressive policy response in 2008 and 2009 helped prevent another depression, and a more timid response in 2011 has aggravated the problems. But the economy was never going to recover quickly from the bubbles. That's why sales, not just of houses, but of appliances, vehicles, even services like entertainment, are all still far below their pre-crisis levels. They will be for a long time to come. It's too late to prevent the last great financial bubble. It's not too late to ask whether we are taking substantial steps to keep the next bubble from being nearly so bad. Remember, there's always a next bubble.
David Leonhardt is an economics writer and the incoming Washington, D.C. bureau chief for The New York Times. What's your economic fix? Send them in, marketplace.org. You can just click on the contact link. Coming up, heat waves in Texas are costing farmers big money.
Our diesel bills that run the irrigation pumps are what we're judging it by, and they're up at least three times, if not maybe four times, what they were last year.
But first, let's do the numbers. Well, the day started with a rally but ended mixed. The Dow Jones Industrial Average picked up 0.3% or 37 points to close at 10,854. The Nasdaq added 0.1%, that's 3 points, to end at 2345. The S&P 500 stood nearly still, ending where it started at 1123. Financial firms couldn't keep up with the Dow. Bank of America took another big hit on mortgage problems, losing nearly 8%. Goldman Sachs unloaded 4.75% amid reports that CEO Lloyd Blankfein hired a high-profile defense attorney. The SEC is investigating Blankfein in regard to the financial crisis. J.P. Morgan Chase pulled back 2.75%, ditto for Citigroup. Gold jumped again, if you're still watching. Today it hit $1,899 an ounce. But bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.11%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, offering IRA savings products and a Raise Your Rate 4-year CD. Learn more at allybank.com. And by FreshBooks, an online invoicing service for freelancers and small businesses designed to help save time, look professional, and make invoicing easy. More at FreshBooks.com. Marketplace Innovation Reporting is supported by the 2011 Jaguar XJ. Learn more at a local dealer or at JaguarUSA.com. Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases its monthly report on mass layoffs. That's when 50 or more workers from one employer lose their jobs. The Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for July. And I Dream of Jeannie star Barbara Eden will be 77. Make a wish. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon, in for Kai Ristall. The back-to-school shopping season is second only to holiday sales for many of the nation's retailers, which explains why Apple and Microsoft are locked in a battle of the freebies right now. Unlike past years, Apple is not offering a free back-to-school iPod to students who buy a Mac. This year, they have to settle for a $100 gift card, good for App Store or iTunes purchases. Microsoft has upped the ante with a free Xbox game console to students who buy a Windows 7 PC, and at least one analyst reports Mac sales are suffering in recent weeks. Andrea Gardner looks at this early lesson in what makes a good deal.
It's a hot summer day at the University of California, Riverside. First-year grad student Carissa Duran sits in a shady spot using her brother's old netbook to shop for a computer. She needs to buy a laptop before school starts next month. First, there's the Mac.
They're really attractive. There's, you know, that image that comes with Apple and everybody needs to have one. I figured maybe I should just go with a MacBook to start.
On the other hand, she says, PCs are more compatible with the computer system on campus. They're also less expensive than Macs.
You want to squeeze every single penny out of every dollar that you have because you're strapped and you're just trying to survive college and not eat top ramen all weekend.
According to consumer research firm Student Monitor, about 1 in 8 college students plans to buy a computer this year. When asked if they'd buy a Mac or a PC, students were split about 50-50. Apple declined to comment, but Microsoft spokeswoman Janelle Poole says college students are an important demographic to pursue.
They have a huge amount of influence in what technology decisions are made in a household, not only for themselves, but also they have an opportunity to influence their parents. You know, this is a group that's grown up living and breathing technology as part of their daily lives.
Right now, PCs have about 70% of the student market, but Apple has been steadily cutting into that dominance. Eric Weil with Student Monitor says the company has gone from 5% of the student market in 2001 to 30% today. He says growing consumer preference towards portability has helped.
Apple was fortunate enough to be out there at the same time that we saw this migration or shift away from desktop computing to laptop computing.
Weil says Apple has been able to capitalize on the popularity of the iPod and the iPhone to drive customers to its laptops. Microsoft seems to be following the same strategy by giving away their popular Xbox consoles. Back at UC Riverside, grad student Carissa Duran says that offer is just too good to pass up. Not because she likes video games, but because she'll probably sell the Xbox on Craigslist.
At the least, I'm sure, brand new product worth $200, you can sell it for $150.
And that will buy a lot of ramen this semester. In Los Angeles, I'm Andrea Gardner for Marketplace.
It just grew from a tropical storm into a hurricane. Irene is its name, and it may have an eye on Florida. For now, the Bahamas are in the hurricane's path, but a tiny tilt west could put it over the Sunshine State by the end of the week. It's already been a record year for extreme weather in the U.S., and likewise for the resulting damages. That means state and federal coffers are already low just as hurricane season ramps up. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Troh reports.
Hollywood blockbusters that spend millions to recreate disasters have nothing on the reality of 2011. We've seen $9 billion disasters in the U.S. this year, $35 billion in total damage from blizzards, tornadoes, floods, droughts, and fires, says the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And states have come to expect federal help, says disaster consultant Eric Holdeman.
Over time, just the average flood has become eligible for a presidential declaration.
That declaration triggers help from FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. It pays for every kind of disaster, terrorism to droughts, with one pool of money. When the pool runs dry, it asks Congress for more. That's an easy ask for a major hurricane or earthquake, but Holdeman says Congress could start pushing back on lesser disasters.
Saying, hey, you have the damages to your property, you're responsible for them.
More individual responsibility at a time when more people have dropped insurance to save money. Craig Fugate is administrator for FEMA. He says many catastrophes his agency pays for could have been predicted.
Yet it took the catastrophe the prompt action. We react to when the system fails versus trying to look at it from the standpoint of how do we invest in a way that minimizes those impacts.
And he doesn't expect that to change. He says it's hard to get federal funding to protect one state from a possible disaster when the next big storm could hit somewhere else. Not to mention the predicted political storms over all federal spending when Congress returns next month. I'm Eve Troh for Marketplace.
And you can add this to the mounting list of disasters this year. The folks in Texas are suffering through the worst year-long drought in that state's history. Last month's heat wave across the country was bad enough, but Texas is still steaming at 100 degrees or better. And being uncomfortable isn't the worst of it, as Erica Aguilar reports from KUT in Austin. The dry spell is bringing with it growing economic pain.
It's 10:30 in the morning, and already the temperature on Dan Picot's tree farm is 94 degrees. Picot grows ornamental trees and sells them to nurseries and landscapers. A sprinkler showers one row, but the wet ground is still fractured, as if a mini earthquake ripped the sun-baked earth into chunks. He irrigates each tree row using one long silver pipe.
And a whole cycle takes us about a week to move. By the end of that week, wherever we started, things are starting to wilt again.
His best-selling tree is the crepe myrtle. Its red and pink flowers bloom despite a summer of bleached-out lawns. But even nurseries are having clearance sales.
They won't buy. If they would normally buy 10, now they'll only want 2 or 3.
Only 6.5 inches of rain have fallen in Texas since last July.
Our diesel bills that run the irrigation pumps are what we're judging it by, and they're up at least 3 times, if not maybe 4 times, what they were last year.
Last week, economists estimated the drought cost farmers and ranchers $5.2 billion since November. Some agricultural experts advise ranchers to move livestock up north temporarily to greener pasture, or ranchers can sell out and try again after the drought. Dr. David Anderson is a livestock economist at Texas A&M University.
For every cow that a rancher is forced to sell, you know, that cow's not going to have a calf next year. That calf won't become a steak 20 months after that. One of the things we will see is certainly some reduced supplies and higher prices on the meat side of things.
For Sherry Earnhardt, selling out is not an option. She raises horses. She has a Craigslist ad online. She'll sell you a horse for $200 or even trade you one for hay. She points to a stack of hay.
That is $850 worth of hay right there. Yes. Had it shipped in from Nebraska. Not the best hay.
Earnhardt's grazing field looks more like a dusty dirt bike track. Hay is what's keeping the horses alive until it rains or someone buys them. She practically gave away 14 horses at the start of the summer.
These are the thinnest my horses have ever been. That's why I gave some away, just because I knew I couldn't handle them, so I got rid of the younger ones.
Earnhardt worries drought is the new Texas summer. And if it is, she, like many others in Texas, might be out of business for good. In Austin, I'm Erica Aguilar for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation.com, monitoring, protecting, and improving reputations online while deleting personal data from the Internet. Reputation.com. By the Batten Institute at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, presenting the Jefferson Innovation Summit, a conversation about creating and sustaining an entrepreneurial future. And by Putnam Investments. You can ask your financial advisor about Putnam 529 for America or visit putnam.com/529. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
A final note, there's an old saying in business, you can try putting lipstick on a pig, but it's still a pig. Well, maybe it depends on what color you use or how many colors you use. A new study by the University of Miami School of Business Administration finds that prettying up a company's annual report can cause investors to place a higher value on the company. Just adding an extra color to the report, for example, can have the same effect on perceptions as a 20% increase in annual revenue. I don't know, color me yellow on this. When I read these reports, I always have a jaundiced view. And that's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 37 points, a third percent. The Nasdaq picked up 3 points, 0.1%. The S&P 500 was flat, ending right where it started. Our producers include Abishai Artsy, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest installment of Breakdown, our economy one step at a time. Next time on this show, one big reason there are more male children in Asian countries, the ultrasound machine.
People see this machine as really a way to ensure them a boy.
The unintended consequences of medical technology. I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.